monument honoring his father, Francesco Sforza, the previous Grand Duke of Milan. After exhaustive researches into the anatomy and movement of horses, da Vinci crafted a plan to create what critics agree would have been the greatest equestrian statue ever produced. After more than a decade of work, Leonardo constructed a model 24 feet high. Vasari wrote that there was never a more beautiful thing or more superb. Leonardo calculated that casting this masterpiece would require more than 80 tons of melted bronze. The bronze, unfortunately, was not forthcoming, as Ludovico needed it to build cannons to stave off invaders. He failed, and in 1499 the French overwhelmed Milan and drove Sforza into exile. In a historical act of bad taste and barbarism that ranks with the Ottoman armies blowing the nose off the Sphinx and the Venetian fleets landing a mortar projectile on the Parthenon, the French archers destroyed the model horse by using it for target practice. Ludovico's defeat meant that Leonardo was without a patron or a home. He found his way to Florence in 1500, and the next year he unveiled his preparatory drawing for the Virgin and Child with St. Anne and the infant St. John, commissioned by the Servite friars. Describing the public reaction, Vasari writes that the painting not only filled every artist with wonder, but when it was set up, men and women, young and old, flocked for 2 days to see it, as if in festival time, and they marveled exceedingly. Although Leonardo never completed the painting for the Servites, his drawings formed the basis of a later work, the exquisitely tender Virgin and Child with St. Anne, now in the Louvre. In 1502, Leonardo shifted his attention from the sublime evocation of divine femininity to take up an appointment as chief engineer to the infamous commander of the papal armies, Cesare Borgia. He traveled extensively for the next year, making 6 remarkably accurate maps of central Italy for his new patron. Despite his access to Leonardo's maps and military innovations, Cesare saw his battlefield fortunes wane. The Signoria of Florence sent Niccolò Machiavelli to advise Borgia in his struggles, but the great strategist was unable to prevent the collapse of Borgia's forces. Machiavelli did, however, befriend Leonardo during this period, a friendship that set the stage for the maestro to receive an important commission from the Signoria of Florence after his return in April 1503. During the same period that he was struggling with the Battle of Anghiari, Leonardo painted a portrait, according to Vasari, of the third wife of a Florentine nobleman, Francesco del Giocondo. Madonna Elisabetta, nicknamed Mona Lisa, was to be immortalized in history's most famous and mysterious painting. Leonardo took the painting with him when he returned to Milan, this time in the service of Louis XII's viceroy, Charles d'Amboise. During his second stay in Milan, Leonardo focused on studies in anatomy, geometry, hydraulics, and flight, while designing and decorating palaces, planning monuments, and building canals for his patron. Leonardo also managed to paint his St. John and Leda and the Swan. In 1512, Lodovico's son Maximilian drove the French out of Milan and established a short reign before being deposed. Leonardo fled to Rome, where he sought the patronage of Leo X, the new Medicean pope, whose brother arranged for him to receive a stipend and lodging at the Vatican. Although the pope was an art lover, he was too preoccupied with the commissions he had already granted Michelangelo and Raphael to pay much attention to the 60-year-old da Vinci. Leonardo rarely held a paintbrush during this time, concentrating primarily on studies of anatomy, optics, and geometry. He did, however, meet and profoundly influence the young Raphael. The lukewarm support he received from the Vatican disappeared altogether with the death of his sponsor in 1516. As Leonardo noted before leaving Rome in disappointment, "The Medici made me and destroyed me." William Manchester comments on da Vinci's lack of papal support. Of all the great Renaissance artists, da Vinci alone was destined to fall from papal grace. In a larger sense, he was a graver menace to medieval society than any Borgia. Cesare merely killed men. Da Vinci, like Copernicus, threatened the certitude that knowledge had been forever fixed by God, the rigid mindset that left no role for curiosity or innovation. Leonardo's cosmology was, in effect, a blunt instrument assaulting the fatuity which had, among other things, permitted a mafia of profane popes to desecrate Christianity. Accompanied by his small entourage of pupils and assistants, Leonardo wound his way through Milan to Amboise in the Loire Valley, knowing he would not return to the land of his birth. The last few years of his life were spent there under the patronage of François I, King of France. Although da Vinci had many patrons and admirers throughout his days, the French king was perhaps the only one who came close to recognizing and appreciating the singular nature of da Vinci's genius. François provided Leonardo with a lovely chateau and a generous stipend, and left the great master free to think and work as he pleased. Although his official title was painter, engineer, and architect of the king, da Vinci's primary obligation was to converse, to muse, and to philosophize with His Majesty. According to Benvenuto Cellini, François affirmed that never had any man come into the world who knew so much as Leonardo, and that not only in sculpture, painting, and architecture, for in addition, he was a great philosopher. Under King François's patronage, Leonardo persevered in his studies, but time was running out. Years of exile had sapped his vitality. Then a severe stroke cost him the use of his right hand. Leonardo saw that he would die without fully realizing his dream of unifying all knowledge. His last days, like much of his life, are shrouded in mystery. He once wrote, "As a day well spent brings blessed sleep, so a life well lived brings a blessed death." Yet elsewhere he noted, "It is with the greatest reluctance that the soul leaves the body, and its sorrow and lamentations are not without cause." Vasari tells us that as death approached, Leonardo, never religious but always deeply spiritual, desired scrupulously to be informed of Catholic practice and the good and holy Christian religion. Leonardo da Vinci died at the age of 67 on May the 2nd, 1519. Vasari claims that in his final days, Leonardo was filled with repentance and apologized to God and man for leaving so much undone. Yet toward the end, Leonardo also wrote, "I shall continue, and I never tire of being useful." Vasari records that Leonardo was observing and describing in scientific detail the nature of his illness and symptoms as he died in the arms of the French king. Although some scholars claim that documents prove that François was elsewhere at the time of da Vinci's death, the evidence is inconclusive, and Vasari may be right. It is easy to believe, however, that the maestro would, even at the moment of death, continue his process of learning and study. The life of Leonardo da Vinci is a mysterious tapestry woven in paradox, dyed in irony. No one has ever attempted so much in so many areas, and yet much of his work was left unfinished. He never completed the Last Supper, the Battle of Anghiari, or the Sforza Horse. Only 17 of his paintings exist, a number of which are incomplete. Although his notebooks contained wondrous information, he never organized and published them as he intended. Scholars have offered a range of social, political, economic, and psychosexual explanations for da Vinci's leaving so many works incomplete. Some have even branded him a failure because he left so much unfinished. Professor Morris Philipson argues convincingly, however, that this is somewhat like criticizing Columbus for not discovering India. Philipson and other scholars all seem to agree, however, that more important than any of his specific accomplishments is the example of the man himself. Leonardo offers the supreme inspiration for reach to exceed grasp. Major accomplishments. In a sentiment echoed later by Freud, biographical novelist Dmitry Merezhkovsky, author of The Romance of Leonardo da Vinci, compared Leonardo to a man who wakes too early while it is still dark and all around him are still sleeping. It would take an encyclopedia to begin to do justice to the full scope of Leonardo's accomplishments. We can get a glimpse of some of his most notable achievements through the categories of art, invention, military engineering, and science. Leonardo the artist transformed the direction of art. He was the first Western artist to make landscape the prime subject of a painting. He pioneered the use of oil paints and the application of perspective, chiaroscuro, contrapposto, sfumato, and many other innovative and influential methods. Leonardo's Mona Lisa and The Last Supper are recognized universally as two of the greatest paintings ever produced. They are certainly the most famous. Leonardo also created other wonderful paintings, including The Virgin of the Rocks, The Madonna and Child with St. Anne, The Adoration of the Magi, St. John the Baptist, and his portrait of Ginevra da Benci that hangs in the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. Although Leonardo's paintings are few in number, his drawings are abundant and equally magnificent. Like the Mona Lisa, Leonardo's canon of proportion has become a universally familiar icon. His studies for the Madonna and Child with St. Anne and the heads of the apostles in the Last Supper, along with his drawings of flowers, anatomy, horses, flight, and flowing water, are unmatched. Leonardo was also renowned as an architect and a sculptor. Most of his architectural work focused on general principles of design, although he did consult on a number of practical projects, including cathedrals in Milan and Pavia, and the French king's chateau at Blois. While he is believed to have contributed to a number of sculptures, scholars agree that the only existing sculptures definitely touched by the maestro's hand are three bronzes on the north door of the baptistry in Florence. The St. John the Baptist preaching to a Levite and a Pharisee was created in collaboration with the sculptor Rustici. Leonardo the inventor made plans for a flying machine, a helicopter, a parachute, and many other marvels, including the extendable ladder, still in use by fire departments today, the three-speed gear shift, a machine for cutting threads in screws, the bicycle, an adjustable monkey wrench, a snorkel, hydraulic jacks, the world's first revolving stage, locks for a canal system, a horizontal water wheel, folding furniture, an olive press, a number of automated musical instruments, a water-powered alarm clock, a therapeutic armchair, and a crane for clearing ditches. More than any single invention, Leonardo deserves credit for pioneering the concept of automation. He designed myriad machines that could save labor and increase productivity. Although some were fanciful and impractical, others, like his automated looms, were portents of the Industrial Revolution. As a military engineer, da Vinci made plans for weapons that would be deployed 400 years later, including the armored tank, machine gun, mortar, guided missile, and submarine. As far as we know, however, nothing he designed was ever used to injure anyone during his lifetime. A man of peace, he referred to war as pazzia bestialissima, beastly madness, and found bloodshed infinitely atrocious. His instruments of war were designed to preserve the chief gift of nature, which is liberty, he wrote. At times, he shared them reluctantly, accompanying one design with a written glimpse of his ambivalence. I do not wish to divulge or publish this because of the evil nature of men. Leonardo the scientist is the subject of considerable scholarly debate. Some scholars suggest that if Leonardo had organized his scientific thoughts and published them, he would have had a massive influence on the development of science. Others argue that he was so far ahead of his time that his work would not have been appreciated even if it was formulated in comprehensible general theories. While Leonardo's science may best be appreciated for its intrinsic value as an expression of his quest for truth, most scholars agree that he can be credited with significant contributions to several disciplines. Anatomy. He pioneered the discipline of modern comparative anatomy. He was the first to draw parts of the body in cross-section. He drew the most detailed and comprehensive representations of humans and horses. He conducted unprecedented scientific studies of the child in the womb. He was the first to make casts of the brain and the ventricles of the heart. Botany. He pioneered modern botanical science. He described geotropism, the gravitational attraction of the earth on some plants, and heliotropism, the attraction of plants toward the sun. He noted that the age of a tree corresponds to the number of rings in its cross-section. He was the first to describe the system of leaf arrangement in plants. Geology and physics. He made significant discoveries about the nature of fossilization, and he was the first to document the phenomenon of soil erosion. As he wrote, Water gnaws at mountains and fills valleys. His physics studies anticipated the modern disciplines of hydrostatics, optics, and mechanics. Leonardo's investigations led him to anticipate many great scientific discoveries, including breakthroughs by Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, and Darwin. 40 years before Copernicus, Da Vinci noted in large letters for emphasis, "Il sole non si muove," the sun does not move. He added, "The earth is not in the center of the circle of the sun, nor in the center of the universe." 60 years before Galileo, he suggested that a large magnifying lens should be employed to study the surface of the moon and other heavenly bodies. 200 years before Newton, anticipating the theory of gravitation, Leonardo wrote, "Every weight tends to fall toward the center by the shortest possible way." And elsewhere, he added that because every heavy substance presses downward and cannot be upheld perpetually, the whole earth must become spherical. 400 years before Darwin, he placed man in the same broad category as monkeys and apes and wrote, "Man does not vary from the animals except in what is accidental." More valuable than any of his specific scientific achievements, Leonardo's approach to knowledge set the stage for modern scientific thinking. Ladies and gentlemen, let's get ready to rumble. Welcome to the Sala del Gran Consiglio of the Palazzo Vecchio for the all-time heavyweight painting championship of the world. On the wall to the right, with the scruffy smock and broken nose, the challenger, Michelangelo Buonarroti, will paint the Battle of Cascina. And on the opposite wall, wearing his trademark rose-colored tunic and carefully groomed blonde curly beard, the champion, Leonardo da Vinci, will paint the Battle of Anghiari. It really happened. Thanks largely to Machiavelli's influence, the Battle of the Battles is the quintessentially Florentine event, expressing the competitive, sharp-edged attitude of that city's fathers, eyes focused clearly on their legacy. Sadly, we know both works only through sketches, copies, and written description. Leonardo attempted an experiment for fixing the paint on the wall that failed. He left the unfinished work as it began to deteriorate, returning to Milan in 1506. Michelangelo was called to Rome by Pope Julius II, leaving only sketches behind. Nevertheless, these two unfinished works had a profound influence on the future of art. According to Kenneth Clark, the battle cartoons of Leonardo and Michelangelo are the turning point of the Renaissance. They initiate the two styles which 16th century painting was to develop, the Baroque and the Classical. Who won the Battle of the Battles? Clark marvels at Leonardo's Baroque design and extols his unsurpassed depiction of horses and individual human faces, while emphasizing that their contemporaries probably favored Michelangelo because of the incomparable beauty of his classical nudes. We know that Michelangelo copied parts of da Vinci's design in his notebook and that Leonardo was influenced by his younger rival to give his own nudes a more heroic pose. We'll call it a draw. Part 2, The Seven Da Vincian Principles. Curiosità, an insatiably curious approach to life, and an unrelenting quest for continuous learning. All of us come into the world curious. Curiosità builds upon that natural impulse, the desire to learn more. We've all got it. The challenge is using and developing it for our own benefit. In the first years of life, our minds are engaged in an unquenchable thirst for knowledge. From birth, and some would argue even before, the baby's every sense is attuned to exploring and learning. Like little scientists, babies experiment with everything in their environment. As soon as they can speak, children start articulating question after question. "Mommy, how does this work? Why was I born? Daddy, where do babies come from?" As a child, Leonardo possessed this intense curiosity about the world around him. He was fascinated with nature, showed a remarkable gift for drawing, and loved mathematics. Vasari records that the young Leonardo questioned his mathematics teacher with such originality that he raised continuous doubts and difficulties for the master who taught him and often confounded him. Great minds go on asking confounding questions with the same intensity throughout their lives. Leonardo's childlike sense of wonder and insatiable curiosity, his breadth and depth of interest, and his willingness to question accepted knowledge never abated. Curiosità fueled the wellspring of his genius throughout his adult life. What were Leonardo's motives? In his book, The Creators, A History of Heroes of the Imagination, Pulitzer Prize winner Daniel Boorstin tells us what they were not. Unlike Dante, he had no passion for a woman. Unlike Giotto, Dante, or Brunelleschi, he seemed to have had no civic loyalty, nor devotion to church or Christ. He willingly accepted commissions from the Medici, the Sforzas, the Borgias, or French kings, from the popes or their enemies. He lacked the sensual worldliness of a Boccaccio or a Chaucer, the recklessness of a Rabelais, the piety of a Dante, or the religious passion of a Michelangelo. Leonardo's loyalty, devotion, and passion were directed instead to the pure quest for truth and beauty. As Freud suggested, he transmuted his passion into inquisitiveness. Leonardo's inquisitiveness was not limited to his formal studies. It informed and enhanced his daily experience of the world around him. In a typical passage from the Notebooks, da Vinci asks, "Do you not see how many and how varied are the actions which are performed by men alone? Do you not see how many different kinds of animals there are, and also of trees and plants and flowers? What variety of hilly and level places, of springs, rivers, cities, public and private buildings, of instruments fitted for man's use, of diverse costumes, ornaments, and arts?" Elsewhere, he adds, "I roamed the countryside searching for answers to things I did not understand. Why shells existed on the tops of mountains, along with the imprints of coral and plants and seaweed usually found in the sea? Why the thunder lasts a longer time than that which causes it? And why immediately on its creation the lightning becomes visible to the eye, while thunder requires time to travel? How the various circles of water form around the spot which has been struck by a stone, and why a bird sustains itself in the air? These questions and other strange phenomena engage my thought throughout my life." Leonardo's intense desire to understand the essence of things led him to develop an investigative style equally noteworthy for its depth of study as for its range of topics. Kenneth Clark, who called him undoubtedly the most curious man who ever lived, describes da Vinci's uncompromising quest in excessively contemporary terms. He wouldn't take yes for an answer. In his anatomic investigations, for example, Leonardo dissected each part of the body from at least three different angles. As he wrote, "This depicting of mine of the human body will be as clear to you as if you had had the natural man before you, and the reason is that if you wish thoroughly to know the parts of the man, anatomically, you or your eye require to see it from different aspects, considering it from below and from above and from its sides, turning it about and seeking the origin of each member. Therefore, by my drawings, every part will be known to you, and by all means of demonstrations, from three different points of view of each part." But his curiosity didn't stop there. Da Vinci studied everything with the same rigor. If multiple perspectives yielded a deeper understanding of the body, for example, they would also help him evaluate his attempts to share that understanding. The result, layer upon layer of rigorous examination, all designed to refine not only his understanding, but its expression, as he explains in his treatise on painting. "We know well that mistakes are more easily detected in the works of others than in one's own. When you are painting, you should take a flat mirror and often look at your work within it, and it will then be seen in reverse and will appear to be by the hand of some other master, and you will be better able to judge of its faults than in any other way." Not content with just one strategy for assessing his work objectively, he adds, "It is also a very good plan every now and then to go away and have a little relaxation, for when you come back to the work, your judgment will be surer, since to remain constantly at work will cause you to lose the power of judgment." And finally, he suggests, "It is also advisable to go some distance away because then the work appears smaller, and more of it is taken in at a glance, and a lack of harmony or proportion in the various parts and the colors of the objects is more readily seen. His inexhaustible quest for truth also inspired him to look at reality from unusual and extreme perspectives. It took him under the water. He designed a snorkel, diving equipment, and a submarine, and into the sky. He designed a helicopter, a parachute, and his famous flying machine. He plunged into unfathomed depths and sought previously unimaginable heights in his passion to understand. Leonardo's fascination with flight, his studies of the atmosphere, wind, and especially the movements of birds, offers a compelling metaphor for his life and work. A page of his notebook depicts a bird in a cage with the caption, "The thoughts turn towards hope." He observes poetically that a mother goldfinch, seeing her children caged, feeds them a bit of a poisonous plant, noting, "Better death than to be without freedom." Giorgio Vasari informs us that in the course of his frequent strolls through the streets of Florence, Leonardo often encountered merchants selling caged birds. It was da Vinci's custom to stop, pay the requisite price, and then open the door of the cage, releasing the prisoners to the endless blue sky. For Leonardo, the quest for knowledge opened the door to freedom. In addition to his helicopter and other flying machines, Leonardo also developed a parachute. If a man has a tent made of linen, of which the apertures have all been stopped up, and it be 12 cubits across and 12 in depth, he will be able to throw himself down from any great height without sustaining injury. Leonardo's work on the parachute is particularly amazing. No one was yet able to fly, and he designed a means for safely exiting a flying machine. And incredibly, Leonardo's proportions for a parachute were the only ones that actually work. Curiosita and You. Written backward, Leonardo's notes are designed to be read in a mirror. Scholars debate the purpose of this mirror writing. Some suggest it was to protect the privacy of his thoughts, while others argue that it was simply a matter of convenience for a left-hander. Great minds ask great questions. The questions that engage our thought on a daily basis reflect our life purpose and influence the quality of our lives. By cultivating a da Vinci-like, open, questing frame of mind, we broaden our universe and improve our ability to travel through it. Have you opened your door to freedom? The exercises that follow are designed to help you do so, but first take a moment to reflect on how frequently and effectively you are already putting your curiosità to work, and how you might benefit from doing so more often. Consider the role of curiosità in your life today. Ask yourself how curious you are. When was the last time you sought knowledge simply for the pursuit of truth? What did you gain from this effort? Think of the people you know. Do any of them strike you as embodying the ideals of curiosità? How are their lives enriched by this? Your curiosità can be developed and put to use more easily than you may have thought. First, complete the self-assessment checklist you are about to hear. Your answers will tell you how you are already using it and where there is room for improvement. Then try your hand at cultivating your own curiosità through the simple exercises that follow. Curiosità self-assessment. I keep a journal or notebook to record my insights and questions. I take adequate time for contemplation and reflection. I am always learning something new. When I am faced with an important decision, I actively seek out different perspectives. I am a voracious reader. I learn from little children. I am skilled at identifying and solving problems. My friends would describe me as open-minded and curious. When I hear or read a new word or phrase, I look it up and make a note of it. I know a lot about other cultures and am always learning more. I know or am involved in learning a language other than my native one. I solicit feedback from my friends, relations, and colleagues. I love learning. 18 sheets of Leonardo's notebooks were purchased by Bill Gates for $30.8 million in November 1994. This is to be a collection without order, taken from many papers, which I have copied here, hoping afterwards to arrange them according to the subjects of which they treat. And I believe that I shall have to repeat the same thing several times, for which, O reader, blame me not. From the front page of one of Leonardo's manuscripts on physics. Curiosita, application, and exercises. Keep a journal or notebook. Leonardo da Vinci carried a notebook with him at all times, so that he could jot down ideas, impressions, and observations as they occurred. His notebooks, 7,000 pages, exist. Most scholars estimate that this is about one-half of the amount he left to Francesco Melzi in his will. Contain jokes and fables, the observations and thoughts of scholars he admired, personal financial records, letters, reflections on domestic problems, philosophical musings and prophecies, plans for inventions, and treatises on anatomy, botany, geology, flight, water, and painting. Notes on different subjects are frequently scribbled on the same page, and many observations appear more than once in different sections. And, of course, the pages are filled with glorious sketches, doodles, and illustrations. Although he expressed an intention to organize and publish them someday, he never got around to it. He was too busy searching for truth and beauty. For Da Vinci, the process of recording questions, observations, and ideas was of great importance. You can, like Leonardo, facilitate curiosità by keeping a notebook or journal. Get a bound notebook or journal filled with blank pages. You can use anything, from the 89-cent Kmart version to a fancy one with an inspiring image on the front cover. The important thing is to carry it with you everywhere and write in it regularly. Supplement your notebook with scrapbooks or files on diverse areas of interest. Cut out and collect newspaper and magazine articles or download information from the Internet on any subject you fancy, science, art, music, food, health. As Leonardo did, use your notebook to record your questions, observations, insights, jokes, dreams, and musings. Mirror writing is optional. Busy lives and job responsibilities tend to drive us toward hard conclusions and measurable results. But the exploratory, free-flowing, unfinished, non-judgmental practice of keeping a Da Vincian notebook encourages freedom of thought and expansion of perspective. In the manner of the maestro, don't worry about order and logical flow, just record. Try the following curiosità exercises in your notebook. 100 questions. In your notebook, make a list of 100 questions that are important to you. Your list can include any kind of question as long as it's something you deem significant. Anything from, how can I save more money, or how can I have more fun, to what is the meaning and purpose of my existence, and how can I best serve the Creator. Do the entire list in one sitting. Write quickly, don't worry about spelling, grammar, or repeating the same question in different words. Recurring questions will alert you to emerging themes. Why 100 questions? The first 20 or so will be off the top of your head. In the next 30 or 40, themes often begin to emerge. And in the latter part of the second half of the list, you are likely to discover unexpected but profound material. When you have finished, read through your list and highlight the themes that emerge. Consider the emerging themes without judging them. Are most of your questions about relationships, business, fun, money, the meaning of life? Top 10 questions. Review your list of 100 questions. Choose the 10 that seem most significant. Then rank them in importance from 1 to 10. Of course, you can add new questions or change the order at any time. Do not attempt to answer them right now. You've done enough just putting them in writing in a place where you can easily find them. 10 power questions. The following questions are drawn from different people's top 10. These questions are powerful catalysts to personal growth and fulfillment. Copy them in your notebook for contemplation. When am I most naturally myself? What people, places, and activities allow me to feel most fully myself? What is one thing I could stop doing, or start doing, or do differently starting today that would most improve the quality of my life? What is my greatest talent? How can I get paid for doing what I love? Who are my most inspiring role models? How can I best be of service to others? What is my heart's deepest desire? How am I perceived by my closest friend, my worst enemy, my boss, my children, my co-workers, etc.? What are the blessings of my life? What legacy would I like to leave? How does a bird fly? Choose one of the following topics inspired by Da Vinci's passionate questioning: a bird in flight, flowing water, the human body, a landscape, reflected light, a knot or braid. And in your journal, ask at least 10 questions about it. Again, there's no need to write answers. In Curiosità, we focus on the questions. For example, how does a bird fly? Why does it have two wings? Why does it have feathers? How does it take off? How does it slow down? How does it accelerate? How high can it fly? When does it sleep? How good is its eyesight? What does it eat? Then choose a topic from your personal or professional life and do the same exercise. Ask 10 questions about your career, your relationship, your health. Record the questions in your journal. No answers yet, just questions. Theme observation. Working with a theme is a powerful tool for focusing your curiosità. Choose a theme for the day and record observations in your notebook. You can jot down your thoughts throughout the day, or just make mental notes to be recorded in your notebook at a quiet time before sleep. Aim to make accurate, simple observations. Speculation, opinion, and theory are fine, but actual observation offers the richest resource. Your list of 100 questions, or the power questions, will provide plenty of themes for this exercise. Additionally, you can choose any of the following or make up your own. Some favorite themes include emotions, seeing, listening, touch, aesthetics, and animals. Do this exercise on your own, or choose a theme with a friend and compare notes at the end of the day. A sample theme exercise. My friend Michael Frederick is a theater director, acting coach, and teacher of the Feldenkrais method, the Alexander technique, and yoga. He has been doing theme work for more than 25 years. He graciously agreed to share the following unedited sample from his notebook. January 10th, 1998. Theme: contact with material objects. 1. 7:40 a.m. Noticed the quality and sense of my feet first touching the floor, that the contact with the floor was supporting me and allowing me to continue lengthening through my body as I stood up for the first time today. 2. 8:20 a.m. As I brushed my teeth, I saw how I was holding my toothbrush too tight in my right hand, and this tension spread up through my arm and shoulder, causing neck tension. Then I looked in the mirror and noticed I was slumping. 11:30 a.m. Holding the telephone with a vice grip and with my head cocked to the right side, causing a pain in my arm and shoulder. Similar to my toothbrush observation, holding onto objects with an over-effort for dear life. 4:30 p.m. While eating a sandwich in a hurry, I saw how I would gobble the food down without paying attention to what I was eating. Speed was important, and this made me lose contact with the taste and even knowing exactly what the sandwich consisted of. 5:30 p.m. I also noticed the sunset today, and the warmth of the sun contacting my face allowed me to slow down and see what was in front of me, i.e., bringing me more into the present moment. 6:30 p.m. Sorting through today's mail, having to take time with the junk mail, i.e., junk material objects, felt like my life is taken up with sorting and filing and fixing and handling material objects. I become a caretaker of these objects. 7:10:30 p.m., As I hold this pen in my hand, I'm noticing how little effort is required to actually write. The pen works very well without the extra effort of pushing. Contemplation exercise. In an age of sound bites, contemplation is becoming a lost art. Attention spans grow shorter, and the soul suffers. To contemplate, as defined by Webster, is to look at with continued attention, to meditate on. It comes from the root contemplare, which means to mark out a temple. Con, with, templum, temple. Or, to gaze attentively. Choose any question from the previous exercises, for example, what people, places, and activities allow me to feel most fully myself. And hold it in your mind for a sustained period, at least 10 minutes at a time. A good way to do this is to take a large sheet of paper and write the question out in big, bold letters. Then, find a quiet, private place and hang it on the wall in front of you. Relax, breathe deeply, allowing extended exhalations. Just sit with your question. When your mind starts to wander, bring it back by reading the question again out loud. It is particularly valuable to do this contemplation exercise before going to sleep, and again upon waking. You will find that if you practice it sincerely, your mind will incubate insights overnight. Stream of consciousness exercise. A powerful complement to contemplation, stream of consciousness writing is a marvelous tool for plumbing the depths of your questions. Choose any question, and working in your notebook, write your thoughts and associations as they occur without editing. Devote at least 10 minutes to writing your responses. The secret of effective stream of consciousness writing is to keep your pen moving. Don't lift it away from the paper or stop to correct your spelling and grammar. Just write continuously. Stream of consciousness writing yields lots of nonsense and redundancy, but can lead to profound insight and understanding. Don't worry if you seem to be writing pure gibberish. This is actually a sign that you are overriding the habitual, superficial aspects of your thought process. As you persevere, keeping your pen on the paper and moving it continuously, you'll eventually open a window through which your intuitive intelligence will shine. Take a break after each stream of consciousness session. Go back to your notebook and read aloud what you have written. Highlight the words or phrases that speak to you most strongly. Again, look for themes, the beginnings of poems, and more questions. Contemplate the metaphor of the poet's motto, write drunk, revise sober. The contemplation and stream of consciousness exercises are excellent tools for personal and professional problem solving. Let's consider the role of curiosità in problem solving a bit further. Curiosità and creative problem solving. Why is the sky blue? Leonardo's answer, I say that the azure that the air makes us see is not its proper color, but this color comes from warm, damp air evaporated into minuscule and imperceptible particles, which, being struck by the light of the sun, become luminous below the obscurity of the mighty darkness which covers them like a lid. Think back to your school days. We all remember what curiosity did to the cat. But what happened to the kids who asked too many questions? A common refrain from overworked, beleaguered teachers was, "We don't have time for all these questions. We've got to get through the curriculum." Now, persistent question askers are diagnosed with attention deficit disorder or hyperactivity and treated with Ritalin and other drugs. If the young Leonardo were alive today and attending grade school, he would probably be on medication. Although we all started life with a Da Vinci-like insatiable curiosity, most of us learned, once we got to school, that answers were more important than questions. In most cases, schooling does not develop curiosity, delight in ambiguity, and question-asking skill. Rather, the thinking skill that's rewarded is figuring out the right answer. That is, the answer held by the person in authority, the teacher. This pattern holds throughout university and postgraduate education, especially in a class where the professor wrote the text. In a classic study at a top university, Summa cum laude graduates were given their same final exams 1 month after graduation, and they all failed. Researcher Leslie Hart summarized the results. Final exams are final indeed. The authority-pleasing, question-suppressing, rule-following approach to education may have served to provide society with assembly-line workers and bureaucrats, but it does not do much to prepare us for a new renaissance. Leonardo da Vinci's life was an exercise in creative problem-solving of the very highest order. The principle of curiositas provides the primary key to his method. It begins with intense curiosity and an open mind, and proceeds with a stream of questions asked from different perspectives. You can increase your problem-solving skills at work and at home by honing your question-asking ability. For most people, this requires shifting the initial emphasis away from focusing on the right answer and toward asking, is this the right question? And what are some different ways of looking at this problem? Successful problem-solving often requires replacing or reframing the initial question. Questions can be framed in a wide variety of ways, and the framing will dramatically influence your ability to find solutions. Psychologist Mark Brown offers the example of an evolution in questioning that resulted in a major transformation of human societies. Nomadic societies were based on the question, how do we get to water? They became agrarian and stable cultures, Brown says, when they began asking, how do we get the water to come to us? Some people like to muse on the philosophical conundrum, what is the meaning of life? But more practical philosophers ask, how can I make my life meaningful? Finding the question. How can you sharpen your question-asking skills so that solutions will start to come to you? Begin by asking the simple, naive questions that sophisticated people are prone to overlook. Da Vinci's questioning was often striking in its simplicity, as when he wrote, I ask why the hammer blow causes the nail to jump out, or why is the sky blue? Ask awkward questions like, why is the emperor naked? Why is this a problem? Is this the real issue? Why have we always done it this way? Aim to raise questions that have not been asked before. Finding illustrative metaphors in nature was one of Leonardo's favorite techniques. When he designed the magnificent spiral staircase for the French king's chateau at Blois, for example, he was inspired by the twisting shells of the conchs that he had collected along Italy's northwestern shore many years before. His design for musical pipes, similar to the recorder, was drawn from his study of the human larynx. More recently, Alexander Graham Bell was inspired to invent the telephone by modeling the ear, the little burrs that stick to your trousers when you walk through the woods, inspired the inventor of the Velcro fastener. And the inventor of the pull-tab top for aluminum cans was inspired by asking himself the question, what in nature opens easily? A picture of a banana popped into his mind, leading him to ask, how can the design of the banana serve as a model for the task at hand? In your notebook, write out a problem or question that you are concerned with in your personal or professional life and ask what, when, who, how, where, and why. What is the problem? What are the underlying issues? What preconceptions, prejudices, or paradigms may be influencing my perception? What will happen if I ignore it? What possibilities may exist that I haven't yet considered? What problems may be caused by solving this problem? What metaphors from nature can I use to illuminate it? When did it start? When does it happen? When doesn't it happen? When will the consequences of it be felt? When must it be resolved? Who cares about it? Who is affected by it? Who created it? Who perpetuates it? Who can help solve it? How does it happen? How can I get more objective information? How can I look at it from unfamiliar perspectives? How can it be changed? How will I know that it has been solved? Where does it happen? Where did it begin? Where haven't I looked? Where else has this happened? Why is it important? Why did it start? Why does it continue? Ask why, 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 why. to get to the bottom of an issue. Curiosità and continuous learning. Leonardo knew the importance of continuous learning. Just as iron rusts from disuse, and stagnant water putrefies, or when cold turns to ice, so our intellect wastes unless it is kept in use. The continuous quest for learning is the powerhouse of the Da Vincian spirit. It is, of course, that spirit that inspires you to read this book. And although it may be impractical for most of us to attempt to master all knowledge, we can further embrace the Da Vincian spirit by learning a new discipline. Over the last 20 years, I've asked thousands of people what they would learn if they could learn anything at all. The most common answers: to play a musical instrument, a new language — Leonardo taught himself Latin when he was 42, scuba diving, sailing, or skydiving, to play tennis or golf, to draw, paint, or sculpt, to act in a play, to sing in a choir, to write poetry or novels, to study dancing, yoga, or martial arts. I call these ideal or dream hobbies, and find that the people who pursue them passionately live richer, more fulfilling lives. Curiosità at work. Most business innovations are inspired by the question, what if? The multi-billion-dollar economy of Silicon Valley was largely inspired by the question, what if we shrunk them? Computer chips. The craze for offering rebates as a sales incentive was born from the question, what if we paid our customers to buy it? What if questions stimulate your imagination and shake up your perspective? Consider any product or service you might offer and ask, what if I shrunk it, enlarged it, made it lighter, made it heavier, changed its shape, reversed it, tightened it, loosened it, added something, subtracted something, interchanged parts, stayed open 24 hours, guaranteed it, changed its name, made it recyclable, stronger, weaker, softer, harder, portable, immovable, doubled the price, or paid customers to take it? The happiest people in the world ask, what if I could find some way to get paid for doing what I love? Over the years, I've encouraged thousands of people to begin their ideal hobby. During that time, I've encountered all sorts of excuses for not doing it, and have developed responses for each. When they say, I'll never be good enough, I tell them to get over it, that Da Vinci wasn't satisfied with his work either. When they say, I'm too busy with my spouse and kids, I suggest that they try getting them involved. When they say, the lessons and equipment are too expensive, I tell them to start saving for it today, creating a special account for their hobby, or to volunteer to assist a master teacher of the discipline they would like to learn. When they claim, I'm much too busy at work, I'll start when things settle down, I point out that things are not going to settle down, and on their deathbed they will be glad that they spent more time following their dreams. And when they say, I'm too old, I should have started when I was young, I remind them that it's never too late. Our learning power can improve with age if we awaken the power of curiosità. Realize your ideal hobby. Working in your notebook, map out a strategy for realizing your ideal hobby now. Make a list of your ideal hobbies. If you are not sure what they are, make some up. Choose one and ask, how specifically will I benefit from this pursuit? What are my goals? What resources will I need? Where can I find a good teacher? How much time will I devote to it? What obstacles must I overcome? The most creative and fulfilled people I know also find answers to the following question, how can I get paid for pursuing my ideal hobby? Making the ideal hobby an integral part of your life is a simple but profound way to contribute to your own personal renaissance. Find a great teacher or coach. Schedule 10 lessons and pay for them in advance. This tends to prevent last-minute excuses and the inertia of habit from interfering with your intention. By pursuing passionately an area of interest, besides work and family, you broaden your perspective in a way that enriches all aspects of your life. You are, in Joseph Campbell's words, following your bliss. Learn a new language. Learning a new language is a popular ideal hobby and a wonderful way to cultivate curiosità. Like Leonardo, you can learn a new language at any age. We all know that babies are the best learners. Their openness, energy, and playfulness allow them to learn languages with ease. A baby raised in a home where three languages are spoken will learn all three without difficulty. The good news is that if you are willing to adopt key aspects of the baby's learning strategy, you can progress with similar ease and delight. And as an adult, you can take advantage of resources that can help you learn even faster than a baby. Let's say, for example, that you wanted to learn La Bella Lingua, the beautiful language, Italian. Here are a few tips for accelerating your language learning. Be willing to make lots of mistakes. Bambinos do not worry about looking cool or instantly achieving perfect pronunciation and grammar. They just dive in and speak. Your progress in learning will correlate directly with your willingness to play and to embrace feelings of unfamiliarity and foolishness. Have you ever noticed how babies will find a word or phrase and repeat it over and over? Do the same. Repetition is the simplest secret of recall. If possible, start your learning process with an immersion course. Just as a rocket needs most of its energy to launch and fly out of our atmosphere, you will get the most from your learning if you launch your efforts with a concentrated program. Your intensive will jumpstart your brain circuitry to start rewiring for your new language. If you can't find a formal immersion course, then create your own by listening to audio cassettes, watching Italian language movies with subtitles, learning the lyrics of great Italian songs like Rondini al Nido and Santa Lucia, singing along to Pavarotti recordings, sitting in Italian espresso bars and just listening to people talking, and going to real Italian restaurants and ordering in the native tongue. If you tell the waiter that you are trying to learn the language and ask for help, you will usually get a free Italian lesson, even better service, and sometimes extra antipasto. Learn words and phrases related to areas of passionate interest. Many language programs are a bit boring because they focus on necessary but mundane matters, such as where is the station and here is my passport. In addition to these everyday matters, aim to learn the language of romance, sex, poetry, art, fine food, and wine. Put Italian translation post-it notes on everything in your house. Most important, open yourself to the feeling of the language and culture. When you speak, pretend you are an Italian. I recommend Marcello Mastroianni or Sofia Loren for starters. Adopt the expressive gestures and facial expressions that go with the language. You will have more fun and learn much faster. Try this little experiment. Say the phrase, the beautiful language, out loud. Now, say it again and notice where the sound resonates in your body. Okay, this time, say it in Italian, as if you were an Italian. La bella lingua. Does it resonate differently? Most people find that English resonates a bit higher, in the throat and the front of the palate, and that Italian resonates farther back in the palate, lower in the throat, and most strongly, in the heart. Build your own lexicon. Another marvelous way to practice continuous learning is to build your own lexicon. In the Codex Trivulzianus and elsewhere, Leonardo noted and defined words that were of particular interest to him. Arranged in columns, the lists include new vocabulary, foreign terms, and neologisms. One list included words such as arduous, difficult, painful, Alpine, of the region of the Alps, Archimandrite, a leader of a group. After defining over 9,000 words, he commented with a delightful blend of pride and humility, I possess so many words in my native language that I ought rather to complain of not understanding things than of lacking for words to express my thoughts properly. This practice is a simple, powerful way to model the maestro and nurture curiosità. A powerful vocabulary correlates significantly with academic and professional success and offers a delightful expansion of your options for self-expression. Every time you discover an unfamiliar word or phrase, look it up and note it in your journal. Then take every opportunity to use it in your writing and everyday conversation. Nurture your emotional intelligence. In addition to strengthening his verbal linguistic intelligence by teaching himself Latin and creating his own lexicon, the maestro also cultivated his emotional intelligence.